Hello and welcome to episode 30 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man and my name is Graham Lee. The topic of this episode is autonomy and software freedom, and while I don't want to go into this sort of side quest, it was motivated by thinking about the recent developments in the governance of the Free Software Foundation and Richard Stallman's continued relationship with that organisation, with the GNU project, and like generally with the way in which the Free Software Foundation's board, voting members and broader membership interact. But it got me thinking about the whole idea of free software and about the successes or failures of the free software movement over the nearly 40 years that it's been going. I think the FSF was founded about 1984 or so, and certainly the GNU project was, the GNU Manifesto was published around then, linked to GNU Manifesto in show notes. We're talking sort of a good 35 to 40 years of history. And a movement that has not necessarily achieved its goals. And so I was thinking about why. Now, this is a problem that's fairly close to my heart. I am a paid-up member of the Free Software Foundation, the Free Software Foundation for Europe, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and the Software Freedom Conservancy. This is a problem I care a lot about, and it's one that I've been involved with for a very long time. I've been using, I first used Linux on an Amiga, I don't know how long ago. It came on the cover disc of a magazine, probably in the late 1990s. Cover CD-ROM, that is, not a, a floppy disk. I've been involved with the GNU Step project on and off since around 2002, using Debian, GNU/Linux, or I believe GNU plus Linux, yeah, whatever we're supposed to call it today. And that indeed itself is going to be a feature of this episode. Along with using like other sort of Unix-based operating systems. But I've always been a professional Unix-based operating systems person. And I think that that is the key message behind any success claimed by the free software movement, is that it has largely worked in the favour of software professionals and enthusiasts, hobbyists. Generally, it's worked in the favour of the experts, but has not passed on the fruits of its successes to the wider computer-using society. We can all look to projects like Android and say, look, the majority of people who use smartphones, which is the majority of people in westernized societies and a bunch of other societies too, all use free software. But then do they actually have the benefits of software freedom? Do they have the ability to use, study, share and improve the software that is deployed to their smartphones? And indeed the rest of the software that those phones interact with? No, they do not. Not in the slightest. The idea that Android has some free software components does not mean that free software is popular, nor that software freedom is available to a large number of people. I mentioned GNU Step. One of the other things that I do in my world of sharing my experiences as a software engineer with people like you is that I co-host a stream called Objective-C Retain, where Stephen Baker and I code Objective-C live on telly for your amusement. And I will put a link to that stream in the show notes as well. So I was As I've talked about before on this podcast, I am studying a PhD, or researching a PhD, I suppose, in software engineering in an academic context. That is, the software engineering is being done in an academic context. Obviously, the PhD is being done in an academic context. And a part of this has been investigating the ethics of software engineering and just asking the question, like, how do software engineers decide what is right or wrong in the products that they're building, and, you know, how are those decisions made, what inputs do they use, what people do they talk to, and so on. And I was reading a paper by a researcher called James H. Moore called Just Consequentialism and Computing, and that paper's from 1999. I will put a link in the show notes, but the link is paywalled, so I don't have a free link to that. You know what, I will look for one, a fairly accessible, like, you know, sort of white market link. But if I don't find one when I prepare the show notes, then I apologize. This is behind a paywall, but the argument of the paper is not material to this episode, because it's only one small footnote that I want to talk about, and I will quote that footnote in its entirety. The idea, and so the paper is called Just Consequentialism and Computing. Just obviously referring to justice and the idea of treating people fairly in, you know, in return for them being sort of fair members of society. Like, this, that's the idea of justice, is that it's this sort of compact that individuals make with society, that in return for acting fairly, they will be treated fairly. Consequentialism is a school of philosophical thought in ethics related to ideas of utilitarianism that basically says that the consequences of your actions are the things that make your actions good or bad, not the sort of internal values of the person who come up with the action, or the values of the society in which the action is performed, nor some sort of external, like, you know, God-given or just universal ideas of what is good and what is bad or evil, but whether the action yields good outcomes, or perhaps even whether whether the actor sort of weighed up the pros and cons of performing an action and decided whether it is whether it would have good consequences or not. This is the consequentialist school of ethics. And if you want to understand the consequentialism idea in ethics, the consequentialist philosophy, then you can do a lot worse than watching the 4 series of The Good Place, the American TV show, which basically explores this idea and its opposition to other forms of ethics in a surprising amount of detail for a sort of mainstream sitcom, but there we go. This author is saying that if we want an online society to use a consequentialist form of ethics, then it needs to consider justice as one of its as one of the consequences in the utility function. So something that is a just action should have a higher score than something that is an unjust action. So fairness should be weighted into the into the debate on what makes good or bad actions. And you can think about this, like, just take the idea, and this was something that one of my supervisors, Dr. Helena Webb, came up with when we were discussing this. If I think I can make better use of your laptop than you can, then I can steal your laptop with impunity because I'm going to make better use of it. Therefore, the outcome of me having the laptop is better than the outcome of me not having it and you having it. Ergo, consequentially, the act of stealing that laptop is a good action. Now, you can basically justify any course of action along a consequentialist means just by saying, well, this is better if I come out on top than if somebody else does, and come up with an argument for that. That is one of the reasons that a lot of people reject a consequentialist form of ethics and prefer what's called a deontological version of ethics, where there is some sort of intrinsic idea of good or evil, or even a pragmatist version, where there is just some sort of temporally contingent, like now society believes that this is good and this is bad, so we should act on the basis that is true until we get more information or society develops or whatever. But you can basically forget any idea of liberty or personal property or any sort of protected aspect of society if you adopt a consequentialist mode of reasoning, because you can say, it's still better for me to ignore that and do this thing. Anyway, that's the thread of the paper that I promised was irrelevant, so I'm definitely already waffling. If you've got 30 episodes into this podcast without noticing that that's a thing, let me explicitly draw it out for you now. That is a thing. I do like to waffle. So anyway, there was a footnote in this paper that made me realise that software freedom is a specific part of a bigger deal. And that bigger deal is what I might call software autonomy or digital autonomy or sort of computer autonomy, something like that. This footnote says that there's a bit in the text that's talking about the idea of autonomy, the idea of being simultaneously an independent actor and yet also embedded in society. It's not about fuck you got mine libertarianism where nobody else exists and you're just out for yourself, but it is about being embedded in a society and yet free to make your own decisions, which is an important part of society. You can't call a society just if it's a tyrannical society and only one person gets to decide what everybody does. A lot of people would not believe that is a good way to run things. But simultaneously, if nobody is looking out for their responsibilities to other people, then you also don't have a society, because there is no shared endeavour and there is no collaboration and betterment and improvement through shared experiences and effort. So the idea of being an autonomous agent in society is somewhere between these two extremes, right? You've got the understanding that there are shared resources, shared expectations, shared outcomes, and that you're contributing towards that, but no compulsion to do so, and a freedom to act as a unique individual within that broader context. And this footnote says the following: ask for, ASKFOR, is a good way to remember the goods of autonomy. So ASK for stands for ability, security, knowledge, freedom, opportunity, resources. So there's this idea of autonomy that I've already described, and that freedom is about 18%, one-sixth of the idea of autonomy. And this immediately made me think, well, that implies that software freedom is one-sixth of a bigger idea like software autonomy or digital autonomy or whatever we want to call it. And in fact, that these things are not mutually exclusive and they are not independent. That freedom needs those other things to be useful. So that is why, going back to my example about Android, we don't say that everybody who has an Android phone has freedom because they all have free software on their phones, because they don't have ability, security, knowledge, opportunity, or resources. And of course, the freedom that they have is somewhat sort of contingent and limited and partial as well. So let's look at why. Let's look at the difference between just having software freedom and having digital autonomy, I'm going to call it. So most free software discussion is very technical. It's very pedantic points about licensing. Stephen Baker makes a good point about this, that the pedantic and technical points about licensing are mostly made by software people who don't understand how law works, but are sometimes made by legal people who don't understand how software works. And there are very few people in the software freedom community that actually straddle both domains and have a decent working understanding of both the legal side and the software side. And, you know, if we look at the sort of the organizations I talked about earlier, Free Software Foundation was started by a software person, Richard Stallman, and a lawyer, Evan Moglen, amongst other people. The Software Freedom Conservancy has as its sort of two main actors, Karen Sandler, a lawyer, and Bradley Kuhn, a software engineer. So, you know, it's where you've got these collaborations between legal experts and software experts that you start to get the motion on these ideas of software freedom. But nonetheless, all we're doing is having these conversations about whether like copyleft or permissive licenses are better, and whether the two clause or three clause BSD license is better, and whether the JSON license counts as open source because it says that the software needs to be used for good and not evil, and is that a violation of freedom zero? These arguments on like legal pedantry really play well into the I don't want to use the phrase open source because that's not quite fair. It's almost fair, but not quite. So I've invented this other term called open source. And I need to describe that a bit before I can like carry this argument on, I've realised. So free software is the thing that was started by Richard Stallman in like the 80s. I think he'd been thinking about it and even writing about it for a few years before that point. But, you can draw a line in the sand that is the GNU Project and the Free Software Foundation and say this was like the birth of the broader movement. And that is the idea that freedom in software terms is a right that people can either have or can not have. And usually when they do not have it, it's because it's been removed. And usually when it's been removed by a vendor of proprietary software. And there's this partly legal but mostly moral or ethical idea of freedom that is being used and applied to software, and that you can either have this freedom or not have this freedom. So this is like a sort of social movement, albeit one that involves computers. Open source originally was an attempt to get businesses, particularly like US businesses, to in the like 1990s, to understand and to adopt software freedom ideas in their sort of technological strategies and in their business strategies by downplaying the word freedom for two reasons. One is that it sounds a bit sort of, you know, hippie, you know, free love and all that kind of thing. And the other is it sounds a bit anti-capitalist, the idea of free meaning zero cost, which is an unfortunate, for our purposes, sort of dual meaning. And so software companies and technology companies in the 1990s understood the idea of open systems, which were systems where the specifications were shared and published for free, and therefore they could be interoperable. And what you did was you competed on the quality of your implementation, or on the ability of people to integrate your platform or your software into a larger sort of enterprise solution. So your open systems weren't open in the sense that open source would be understood, but they were open in the sense that you could interoperate with each other. They were not sort of completely walled gardens. And you know, there are examples of systems that are not open source, but they use the word open because they come from this open systems idea. So OpenStep is one of those. OpenVMS is one of those. And Apple's defunct OpenDoc is a third one. So we use the pun open source, open systems to make software freedom sound like a thing that CTOs are already comfortable with, and CIOs and CEOs already understand and already bought into. And then we say, look, this is kind of taking that idea one step further. And so this is like one step better for your business. And that's open source as it was originally conceived and enacted at, you know, companies like Netscape, which became Mozilla. Then there is the open source movement, which is the observation that technologists love open source because it gives them an ability to kind of to place themselves in the public domain and to share what they're doing and to have some public performance of their expertise and knowledge and skills, but that is not aligned with the idea of either software freedom as a social good or open source as a business idea. So open source is the idea that proprietary software companies can co-opt open source to get work at significantly lower costs than they otherwise would, but not have to change the way they do business or support these hippie ideas of freedom and justice online. You look at something like GitHub, and GitHub would have the strapline, "We love open source." They are one of the biggest repositories of open source software, and yet what they sell is a proprietary platform. You cannot get the source code to GitHub, despite the fact that it's based on Rails, and Rails had that transitive dependency on libmagic, which means that it ought to be GPL2. Microsoft is still not giving you the source code to GitHub, and so they have built this massive proprietary platform while co-opting ideas of open source software, and that is open source. And these arguments about like legal pedantry and choice of one license over another completely minimize or hide any idea of like the sort of social benefit, because it's not talking about whether it is socially better to have the copyleft license or to have the protections of copyleft versus the restrictions that are imposed on the people who adopt copyleft licenses. It is about whether you are conforming with the letter of this particular license, or whether it would be better to put this other license on or whatever. That makes it very easy to derail the larger questions of justice and freedom and focus down on narrow technical pedantic issues, and thus hide the moral basis for any decisions taken. So an open source organization can claim to be better at open source than a free software organization because they are working with this particular licensing regime or doing a better job at licensing conformance within this regime than another organization, whilst hiding the fact that they do not actually support any of the goals of free software or open source software. So that means that what we have to do, if for those of us who care about these ideas to the extent that we've been members of these societies for years, have supported their campaigns, given them not insignificant chunks of money, contributed towards their projects and so on, we have to kind of bring that conversation back up to the level of moral basis, I think, and it becomes easier to do when you stop thinking about the moral basis for software freedom and start thinking about the moral basis for digital autonomy. Because when you talk about digital autonomy, freedom is one of the necessary components that ask for contains freedom as one of its six components alongside ability, security, knowledge, opportunity and resources. And by fitting it into that context, it makes it easier to see why freedom is important. And it also makes it easier to see, I think, what is lost when it is not provided. And yeah, we can see that some of the organisations have these other ideas in mind. The Free Software Foundation of Europe had still has a campaign called Public Money, Public Code. And that is definitely about freedom, software freedom, as an idea of fairness or justice. If the collective taxpayers of the European Union are paying for this software, then the collective taxpayers of the European Union should own this software. It shouldn't be something that can be owned, controlled and financialized or commoditized by some private company that doesn't represent all of those people. That is definitely a freedom argument. But on the other hand, the Free Software Foundation's campaign against digital restrictions management is more of an autonomy one. It's it's not saying we demand that the Fair Play DRM in Apple Podcasts or iTunes or movies or whatever should be open source or should be published under a free software license or a copyleft license. It's saying that feature, or rather anti-feature, should not exist. It should not be it should not be done that people are recommended to use software that limits what they can do. And it's an argument for autonomy. For I have got this software in good faith. I have purchased this movie in good faith. I should be allowed to use this movie in good faith. So that is an example of an argument that takes a sort of scale up and a bigger view of the world than purely a freedom-based view. So what else do we need? What do these other aspects of autonomy look like in the digital world? I think the first thing we need to do is we need to get out of this sort of... I'm going to not hold back here. I'm going to call it victim-blaming culture of saying that everybody must learn to code. And that that is the way that we will get independence and autonomy for everybody in an online community, is when they are all programmers. And there are there are a bunch of problems with this view. I've called it victim blaming, and I will defend that statement by saying that the obvious corollary of everybody who wants software freedom must learn to code is that anybody who does not want to learn to code does not deserve software freedom. And that is not true. Software is according to Mark Andreessen, eating the world. The societies that we live in, whether they're like operated by big Silicon Valley businesses, by like large governments, by transnational organizations like World Trade or International Monetary Fund, or any of these, the European Union, any of these big intergovernmental organizations, this all runs on software. And so anyone who is in that system, you know, anyone who is in a United Nations company is being handled through through a United Nations country. That was a one too many William Gibson novels, I think, or one too many GNTs. Anyone who is in one of these United Nations countries is being handled and is having large amounts of their life handled through software. Anyone who works is probably like being paid through software, whether it's the payroll system, whether it's their bank account, even if they're being paid cash in hand and it's being recorded on the spreadsheet somewhere, like they are being paid through software, and therefore software is critical to their lives, even if they do not consider themselves a like computer literate actor, computer savvy actor, or computer programmer. So expecting all of these people to learn to code just because that is the only way that you can imagine them understanding the world of computers is like morally bankrupt and is a ridiculous requirement. It now means that everybody has to learn the trappings of two careers, the bodies of knowledge, the ethical frameworks, the professional judgment of two careers, the job that they're trying to do, and of computing, when computing is very like technical discipline, one that requires a lot of both like upfront education and on the job experience to get proficient at, and you want to do that alongside driving a train, brain surgery, being a nurse, being a bus driver, being a coast guard, whatever it is that you do during the rest of your life. Like, it's just not a fair imposition to put on people. So no, we exclude the idea that everybody has to learn to code. We reject it. But that doesn't obviate the A and the K in ask for, the ability and the knowledge. It just means we have to ask what we mean by ability and knowledge. And ensuring that the requirements we impose are realistic. And I think that what the requirements we impose are on the providers of software, of algorithms, of like digital contributions to society in general, they have to provide essentially informed consent. They have to describe the ways in which their software products or processes or whatever is involved are going to impact on the people who are either engaging with them or are subjected to them, depending on the form of the mechanism, and to make it clear what the ramifications are, what the opportunities for engagement, for protest, for rejection are, and to offer people those opportunities throughout the engagement, throughout the interaction with the process. So knowledge, for example, could mean I get a full description of what happens to my computer when I install your software on it. And that, like, if you're in the free software world, then that probably means use the source, Luke. It means I've given you the source code to this application, so as long as you're willing to read the source code for the KMail mail client, and the KDE libraries, and the Qt libraries, and the GNU operating system, and the Linux kernel, then you know what's going to go on your computer. No, that we have gone back to the rejected position of you need to understand how to code before you are allowed to have freedom. So there is a gap between you need to know everything about computering before you can understand this thing, and you don't get to be told anything about it. And there's a position in the middle that is worth exploring, because it would give people the ability to make informed judgments about what their computer is doing based on knowledge of what software they are interacting with and how it works and what its consequences are. Another of the fields in Ask For, another of the expanded words in the acronym, is the opportunity, the O, and so we ask, well, the opportunity for what? Is that the opportunity to, well, if it's autonomy, then it's the opportunity to forge one's own destiny, right? So we might say the opportunity to opt out of the Silicon Valley hegemony. You know, Stephen Baker uses this example that there's a tool called BankID in Sweden, and all Swedish citizens basically need to have BankID in order to authenticate themselves for a bunch of situations in being a Swedish citizen. And this BankID is distributed as an app which exists on iOS or Android. So you can't opt out of the Silicon Valley hegemony. You can't just get a free phone or a Pine phone or even a feature phone as your, as your only phone, or not use a phone at all without basically being unable to operate as a Swedish citizen. Netherlands has a similar thing called Digidentity is how I would pronounce it. Probably Digidentity is how a Dutch person would pronounce it. Anyway, this is not something that has been provided by the scions of free software. If we look at the culture around free software, there definitely are digital hermits, people like Richard Stallman. I might mention Leah Rowe of the Core Boot Project, or Libre Boot. There are people who can survive just using fully free software, and they tend to be deeply embedded in the free software world. There hasn't been a sort of wholesale alternative culture that has been promoted as both desirable or even feasible by the free software community. As an example of this, we look at Canonical closing their bug number one, which was Microsoft has a majority market share. And they closed it because Apple and Google had supplanted Microsoft as the hegemonic majorities in the computing world, not because of the actual desirable outcome in the bug report was a majority of the PCs for sale should include only free software. Well, that is still not true. And if we, as they tried to do in closing this bug, incorporate the smartphone world into our idea of what a PC is, then the situation is only worse than it was when the majority was Windows PCs. If you look at Microsoft's antitrust lawsuits in the 90s, the things that threatened to split Microsoft into multiple companies, they were over in the US, Microsoft having a browser that was embedded in their operating system that you couldn't replace. Well, that is true on all Android smartphones that you buy. You can install other ones, but you can't uninstall the built-in one. And it is even worse on the Apple phone, where you can only use their web browser, and everybody else's web browser is their web browser but reskinned.
And in Europe, the fact that they had a media player that was built in to the operating system and that could be removed or changed. And again, you know, how do I get rid of iTunes from my, or rather Apple Music as it is now, from my Apple phone? I can't do that. So the situation now, you know, the opportunities for digital autonomy are much worse on the you know, in the world that we exist in now than the one that existed when Canonical created the Ubuntu project. And yet, for some reason, they have closed their bug that said that this problem needed fixing. I also want to bring up the security argument. So one of the S in ask for stands for security. Obviously, in the world of software, we have this sort of narrow infosec idea where we talk about security. And I think that is part of a bigger idea of security. And it's an important, though far from, like, you know, sort of a major part of security. The security that I think is meant in ask for is in the sense of being comfortable in the knowledge that basic needs are met. Like, not having to worry that, and this is a significant worry. If you look at the what we were just talking about with the Swedish idea of bank ID, like, if I can't make free choices without failing to operate in society, if I can't, like, you know, pay my rent or get a job, if I'm not bought into the Silicon Valley view of how computing works, then I do not have security in an online context. So, Neil, we could argue maybe it's hypocritical to look at ideas of digital autonomy when there's still war and famine and hunger and disease. Like, you know, these are security issues for a load of people that we need to fix before we start to worry about, you know, whether their smartphones are their friends or their enemies. I don't think that, you know, I think that that is an attempt to defer a complex problem by saying, by using whataboutism, by saying, but look, there's this other problem, we should solve that problem first. If we can't fix the idea of digital autonomy for you know, for the people who are already in a predominantly digital existence, predominantly online existence, which is probably somewhere between a sizable minority and a small majority of the people on the planet, what basis is there for deferring this this problem to later, and then when it impacts everybody on the planet, what will make it easier to solve then? Surely it would be better to solve it at the earliest opportunity and then invite people into this secure and autonomous society. And, you know, there are so many ways in which security is violated in a digital society. Software as a service violates basic ideas of security. If I have access to some software now, but it's on someone's cloud server, I A, don't know whether it's going to be available when I need to use it because of the way that the cloud works. But I also don't know whether it's going to work in the way that I have learned at the time that I need to use it, because they could just deploy a new version at a moment's notice that completely changes the way that I interact with it. Obviously, that is true for automatically updating software in local contexts as well. So I have to choose whether to engage with auto-update mechanisms in order to preserve my understanding of the software. And so that is a security-violating workflow as well. It's one where I don't have knowledge of how the software is going to work based on knowledge of how it used to work. Opaque AI algorithms used by governments or by large companies also defy security. And I have an article that I co-wrote in a national paper in the UK that I'm going to link in the show notes that goes into that argument in more detail. So is there a conclusion out of any of this? Well, evidently we're nowhere near providing digital autonomy, and organisations that are focusing on software freedom are doing two things. One is missing the bigger picture that freedom is merely one property of autonomous agency within a digital culture or digital society. And the other is that through focus on one narrow concept, they leave themselves open to derailing arguments by focusing on technical minutiae of conformance in that context, whilst ignoring the bigger question of whether ethical values are satisfied or whether moral requirements are being met. Nonetheless, I think that this framing of freedom as part of a bigger problem of digital autonomy provides some useful context to the historical movement that is software freedom, and shows where future campaigns and future attention should be focused. So that is it for this episode. Although not necessarily it for the conversation, as ever, I would happily discuss this with you. Comment on the post where you found this podcast. Email grahamlee@acm.org. I'd love to talk to you about this, and I will talk to you again soon. Take care.